Good morning. This is Right Here, Right Now, brought to you by Right Choice Services. I'm your host, Tim Morrison. On Right Here, Right Now, we interview business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals about their work and the book they have written, are in the process of writing, or intend to write someday. My co-host and the producer of Right Here, Right Now is Andy Lowe, and Andy also hosts his own show, Renegade Radio. Good morning, Andy.
Dr. Tim, how are you doing this morning?
I am doing great. Last Tuesday, Vanessa sat in for me while I kind of sort of vacationed, and I attended my 45th high school reunion. So how did the show go?
It went very well. I mean, I don't know if you went back and listened to it. We poked a little fun at you. I mean, you know, this...
I guess I will have to go listen now, won't I?
Well, we talked about, you know, your class reunion, wondering if you guys were still communicating with stone tablets. So,
well, we were.
I thought you might, you know.
We probably were, yeah. You know, the interesting thing is I had two buddies, John Matheson and Bob Nace, and we did everything together, and we realized that was the first time we had been together in 42 years, all three of us. Two of us from different times. But the last time all three of us were together was when Bob got married back in the summer of 1970. It was great.
You know, the interesting thing about seeing old friends and classmates like that is always intriguing to me. One is you feel like back in the day, like when you're in the moment, you feel like, you know, these will be your friends forever. Mm-hmm. And you'll never lose contact.
Yeah.
And then ultimately you do.
I do.
And the second thing that's interesting to me, looking back over my life, is losing that contact is completely avoidable. It's really just, it kind of fades from mind and people don't make the effort. There's really no reason you lost the contact. You just kind of do.
That's right. That's right. So we got back in touch, and I think we're going to stay that way. It was fun.
Well, good. Well, glad to hear about it. Well, what have we got on tap for today? I understand we got a good guest here.
We always have a good guest, but we really got a great one today. Mike Dunham is with us. He's a partner at Gibson, Deal, Fletcher, and Dunham Law Offices. And Mike gets to be the first guest as we begin to shift our focus a little bit in our program. We're going to be talking about the book that begs to be written. At Right Choice Services and Right Here, Right Now, we believe that business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals have a book staring at them that does indeed beg to be written. You know, and that book doesn't have to be long or involved. It just has to have some solid information and provide insight. And that's exactly what Mike has done. He's drawn upon the Georgia legal code and his own practice. And he's crafted an insightful book to help both landlords and tenants understand the laws and processes pertinent to rental property. I met Mike, probably 2 years ago, maybe three, at an open networking, and he's the first attorney that I've met that stands up and says, I like doing courtroom, doing trials. And that's impressive, and I like that, and it's good to have somebody on your side like him. So we're going to focus our conversation on the process of writing, how he identified his book. And in fact, he handed me, hot off the press literally, a first copy. He got the book today. And as I said earlier, today's guest is Mike Dunham. He is a partner at Gibson, Deal, Fletcher, and Dunham Law Offices. He does have extensive experience in landlord-tenant matters. He enjoys being in the courtroom and working with trials. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks, Tim. It's good to be here.
Great. How did you figure out this book that begs to be written, A Brief Guide to Georgia Evictions, Helping Landlords Navigate the Legal Maze?
Well, it was kind of a long road. About 2 years ago, I was supposed to be on a continuing legal education faculty in Augusta, of all places. It was a landlord and tenant seminar. It was a kind of a, I don't know what the word is, or I forget the word right now, but kind of an institute kind of thing where they were taking you through a whole shotgun of the law. And the part that they wanted me to focus on was the eviction process in that one. And I took advantage of that opportunity, spent a good bit of time putting materials together, only to have them call me 2 days before the seminar was supposed to go on and say, well, only two people signed up, so we've decided to pull the plug. And I said, well, I guess my silver lining is you decided not to make me drive to Augusta to find that out.
Yeah, that's good.
But I had a couple dozen pages of materials that went into their materials that I now, you know, was free to do whatever with. I didn't know what to do with it, so I converted it to PDF, and I put it on the internet and linked into it with my LinkedIn profile and just kind of left it out there and said, here, if anybody can find this useful, you can have it. And it just sat there. And then I guess it was February or so of this year, about 6 months ago, wasn't it, Tim? We were at one of those, a regular event that we go to have gone to several times, and I'd already gotten to know you a little bit, but I remember you stood up and you said something you had said many times before in your elevator speech, which was, everyone has a book in them. And the other thing you did that day, you had a little book that was about the size of a CD jewel case.
Yes, yes.
It has a yellow-orange kind of cover, and I may screw up the title, but it was something like Basic Tips for Beginning Writers.
You got it.
Okay. And you handed those out like business cards.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that day you were telling everyone, you know, something like this. And this was a book that I literally sat there and read during the meeting.
Exactly.
It took 15 minutes to read. I know it took you longer than that to write, even though it felt... You know,
it took me a weekend to write it.
Well, you've clearly got experience writing.
That's true. That's true.
And that, I know, wasn't your first book and presumably wasn't your last.
Yeah.
But one of the things you pointed out was the cost. Not that cost should really have anything to do with it, but you compared it to the cost of a full-color trifold brochure and
that's
said
right.
It wasn't that much more expensive to produce one of these.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what you meant was... Once you have the book written and have invested the time that it takes to do that, it doesn't take much to produce. And you're right. The producing the books is, you know, the cost is relatively trivial. Obviously, it's a little bit more of a commitment to actually make the book. But
Andy, anyway. I did not pay him for that. I want to go on record.
All right. Okay. Duly noted.
You made me sign something. Was that?
I know. I did see a contract that got signed here.
Yeah,
today, so.
Yeah. I appreciate you saying that because that's what I try to do, Mike. And actually, if people are listening to this show, if you go back to the archives of Right Here, Right Now in December, I was actually interviewed by Vanessa on that. And we call it Your Unique Business Card. But that's for people who want to create a book without a whole lot of effort and a whole lot of money. That's right down the alley for that. But this got you going on this handbook, and this was an amazing adventure for me as I edited and coached you through it. I learned a lot in terms of legal terminology for number one, but then the other. Some other stuff is just how it was processed. How much more did you add to it after you had created your PDF?
Well, the PDF was 21 typewritten pages, I think, and there was some white space. And what you've got in your hand is 114 or 15 pages total, I think. Now, the sort of substantive material, a lot of that is appendixes. I've got copies of relevant code sections and some forms and that sort of thing, stuff that you wouldn't, generally speaking, outright read.
Yes.
But is handy for you to refer to. The idea behind this book is that you can be, I think the ideal target market is the guy that buys a commercial, or not even a commercial, but the guy that buys a rental property on a shoestring. I was in another networking meeting not too long ago, a few months, but not too long ago, and one of the realtors that was in that meeting stood up and said, there are people buying rental properties on credit cards. You can literally buy a house that's a foreclosure for $15,000 or $18,000 or $20,000. I'm not suggesting that as appropriate investment advice, but there are people doing it. And the point is, and I've run across a lot of these people in my practice, there are people who have rental properties who are operating at the most razor-thin margins you can imagine. They don't even know it, frankly, going in sometimes. They see it and say, okay, my mortgage payment on this rental property is X. I'm going to charge 120% of X for rent and get a security deposit. And my tenant is going to move in and they're just going to pay the rent. And I'm going to pocket that 20%. It's all going to be hunky-dory. They forget about the fact that the property has to be maintained under the best of conditions. If you're buying these cheap properties, you've got large projects in front of you. You know, an $18,000 house is probably going to need, you know, new everything, new paint, new air conditioning unit, plumbing. There's a host of problems, and it's never ending. And guess what? You're the landlord. It's your job to solve them. They forget about that part of it. They also forget about the fact that sometimes tenants don't pay. And if the tenant doesn't pay, you don't even have your mortgage covered that month. Hopefully you've got a more solid business plan. Hopefully you've done something to make sure that you've vetted your tenant appropriately. But things happen, you know, mm-hmm. even the best intention, well-intentioned tenants don't pay because they lose their job or they get hurt or something happens. So anyway, these guys don't want to hire lawyers, frankly. We cost too much, let's mm-hmm. be honest. And we definitely cost too much for guys that don't have the money because they're so strapped because of what this rental property has done to them. So I identify a market there for something like this. And my intention is that someone would pick up this book who is a commercial. I keep saying commercial. I got that on the brain. Who is a rental property owner who wants to try and navigate the process themselves. Well, the other side of my or earlier in my practice, I was actually in law school and I was an intern for the Fulton County Landlord-Tenant Mediation Project. Fulton County, for those who may be listening and don't know, is basically Atlanta. That's the county that where most of Atlanta sits. It's one of the biggest, in terms of population, it's one mm-hmm. of the biggest counties in the state. Might be the biggest one, I'm not sure. And there's something like 1,000 cases a week moving through in the dispossessory context only. They have, so we were working... And the way they set it up, I think it's still done this way, but the way it was set up back in 2002 when I was doing that for them, they would have two calendars twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. They'd have them at 2 and they'd have them at 4. And basically, if the tenant filed an answer of any kind, they'd put it on the 2 o'clock calendar and they'd want us to try and mediate it. They would have 10 mediators on staff ready to go. They would have, on average, probably 80 cases on one of those 2 o'clock calendars. And if the case didn't settle, then it got moved to the 4 o'clock calendar and tried that day. So we would be mediating cases. There's 10 of us. You know, ideally, we would be all done with all of them at 4 o'clock. So if you just do the math on that, that's 8, you know, 80 cases for 10 mediators is 8 apiece in 2 hours. That's 15 minutes per case. It's stack them, pack them, and rack them time and just get them out of the way. The law itself is fairly straightforward. You know, as law students, we were able to learn it within a matter of weeks, and we had it pretty well down pat. You see a lot of the same lawyers come through, the same, you know, mm-hmm. and those cases would go very quickly and because they're fairly straightforward. I mean, the bottom line is, generally speaking, either the tenant didn't pay the rent or there's some sort of repair failure, and that's where the dispute is. Sometimes it could be worked out. Most of the time, frankly, it could be worked out, and the judge always liked it that way. But anyway, the number of, take this in the spirit which is intended, uneducated, unsophisticated landlords moving through that court, to me, means this book begged to be written, to use your phrase.
I got it. That makes sense.
It's not necessarily that the landlords are stupid or that they aren't capable of handling the process. I just think that they need more instruction, more guidance. Let's be honest, the law is an opaque thing. That's why we have lawyers.
Well, let me ask a question that some people out there that are experts, such as yourself, in their given area might think. This is your wheelhouse of work. This is something that you do and something that you get paid for, is to help people through this type of process. What was the thinking in writing a book? I mean, essentially, you're putting knowledge and information that you could be getting paid for out there for a much subsidized cost. You know, is this something that you believe will... help those who maybe can't engage you from a business side? Has it enhanced your business? I mean, I think this is a battle that especially a lot of consultants, coaches, and experts face. How much of my information do I give away?
Right. I think it's a good question. It's one you have to ask yourself when you're going to write something like this. The easy answer is the people who are buying that book were never going to pay me in the first place. The book is $39 one time. $39... just be candid, isn't going to buy very much of my time. It's certainly not going to buy a courtroom appearance from me. Now, having said that, I do expect some people will buy the book, recognize that they can't eat this elephant on their own, and will come back and hire me or another lawyer. Frankly, it's okay. There's enough business out there that I think those of us who want and ask for enough business will find it. But I think a lot of them would, you know, I would hope they would start with the, you know, recognized expert published author type, which is the real reason to write the book. And I think a fair number of them will come back. There are also some people. I had a client, very sweet lady. She owned a rental house out in Gwinnett County. I had to help her evict her tenant. And a couple things happened there. One, and I don't want to get too technical and bore anybody, with the details, but we started in magistrate court where most of these cases start. The tenant was getting some, I don't want to say legal advice, but was getting some advice from somebody who was savvy and knew how to work the system a little bit and figured out how to appeal it to superior court. So we basically had to retry the case again in superior court. And then she figured out how to at least file an appeal to get it to the actual Georgia Court of Appeals, and I got it dismissed. But she wasn't going to be able to navigate that process on her own. And all of that was compounded by the fact that English is not her native language. This lady was a Korean national. Now, her children had been born and raised here, and they spoke very good English, were very intelligent. It was a kind of a family endeavor. Mm-hmm. And her daughter came to court with her, 19 or 20 years old. And that was invaluable to me because I don't speak Korean. But she wasn't going to be allowed to translate for her mother in a courtroom context.
Oh, really?
So
wow.
her mother would have needed to be able to speak English, not for any, you know, I don't want to get political or any of that. It's not about that. It's just a structural matter. You know, the translators have to go through a certification process and so on and so forth. So that lady can't represent herself in court, even though she, believe me, would have preferred not to have to pay me to help her with that case. So, you know, there are still, I think, plenty of cases out there where they're going to hire me. And frankly, this book is going to weed out the ones that were never going to hire me or pay me or be good clients in the long run anyway.
Well, that's an interesting comment, yeah. You know, to think about. I mean, is it being a weeding out process?
Sure,
yeah.
Sure. Well, what it does for me, too, and I've been referring people or suggesting people contact Mike ever since I met him for various things, especially if they are snarly and say they want to fight it in court. I said, I know the man for you. But what this does...
I appreciate that.
Yeah. What having this book... Now, I can say to them, hey, look, the guy has written a book. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to navigate, if you will, whatever, and he's put it in writing. And that ups your credibility. It's an exciting kind of thing to do. What was it like to write this? Yeah, you've got the law code in here, but I keep flipping through here, and you have some commentary. You explain what it is. The crux of it all is your own words, your own explanation.
This is, and I'm too young to say this is the culmination of my career because I got a lot of time in front of me, hopefully. But this is it's several different pieces of my background put together. I have a background in teaching. I was a teacher in college, and I've actually been an adjunct professor at Gwinnett Technical. I'd spent a year teaching microeconomics, believe it or not, and business law, which makes more sense. And I think good trial lawyers, and I hope I'm a good trial lawyer, but I think good trial lawyers are good educators, mm-hmm. people who are good at explaining what they do. Another thing I think a good lawyer is a good writer. We write day to day, and I know this is something you want to circle back to later, but
yeah.
I think I've been told I have something of a gift when it comes to writing. I hate putting it that way because it sounds like you have to be born with it. I don't think that's true. I think it's something that can be honed, and I think it's something that can be learned and practiced. But I do think I have a way with words, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And then, you know, on top of that, this is an actual something that I'm interested in, passionate about, knowledgeable about. So all of those things kind of came together. I had, you know, your question was, talk about writing the book. Well, mm-hmm. I'd written those CLE materials, and a question that I think we got away from before was, you asked me, you know, how much did you add? I would think probably 80% of what was in that first draft, mm-hmm. basically, wound up in the book. Mm-hmm. I remember after that meeting that I described before, I emailed that to you and said, what do mm-hmm. you think? Is there mm-hmm. something here? And your response was in a word, yes, there's something here. And then we met so that I could ask questions about, you know, the process and what I needed to do and what I needed to know. And you were very good about answering all of those questions. And I said, what's the hard part? What am I missing? And I remember you looking at me, you said, the hard part is writing it. And you've already done that. That, of course, was not true.
Oops.
No, the hard part is writing it. And I'd already written something, but... you know, the old, all authors say this and learn this, and I know you've heard this adage before, but writing is rewriting.
Mm-hmm.
And every sentence in there has been touched. I've I kind of flipped out over the weekend because I found a typo. Even after 9 edits of the book, I actually found a typo in the thing on like page 2 or something. And I didn't even find it. It was a friend that found it. Of course, I wouldn't have found it. I apparently had read that sentence 15 times and not seen
but
it.
But that happens.
That happens. I can get it fixed. But the point is, you have to constantly massage to make sure everything is, you know, every sentence has to say what you want it to say and has to add information. And one thing, comment that I get, I've let a few people read it, or asked a few people to read it, and they've been gracious enough to do so. One comment I keep getting is that this is very dense writing. And it is. And it's a dense topic. It's boring, let's be honest. People keep saying, you know, there's nothing, I feel like I'm missing something when I read through it because there's just so much here. And that was kind of, I don't intend you to miss something, but I do intend that every single sentence, every single word convey information if possible.
Well, it addresses what you're about. And as you know, I did this with you. I do it with all of my clients. Who's your target market? And what's your theme? And I asked for 150-word synopsis, and I was anxious to see what you were going to come up with this kind of document. But you did it. You did it, and you did it well. And so I knew when I read through it that it was going to be dense. But the measure I used was, can I understand it?
Right.
Did it make sense? And I know some of the questions I asked you were, is this a legal term or is this just something you use? Can we change it? And oftentimes it was a legal term. And so therefore we had to keep it. But what you also did was you have a glossary. That's right. The word? You've got a glossary.
I even used that word.
Yeah, and there it is.
And that was basically your idea, without whether you realize it or not, because you kept asking me this, you know, what does this mean? What does this mean? What does this mean? And it's stuff that it's a language I've been speaking for 10 years.
Exactly, you know? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now, was there an intent in making the book this dense? I mean, you know, my mindset goes to a lot of books that are out on the market right now, especially from experts on ways to do this or that. And a lot of books, in my opinion, having read them, are waste of paper. Yeah. I mean, you have a 150, 250-page book that really is about 4 pages of information.
Yep.
They give a sentence or two of info.
That are repeated 25 times
exactly.
throughout the
book. And they never hit the punchline. They never really give you the info, right?
One of the biggest sort of violators of that or abusers of that, in my experience, is computer technical manuals, computer books, where you'll pick up this book. It'll be literally 1,000 pages on how to write a web page. And there is probably 1,000 pages of stuff that could be written about how to write a web page. But those books always let me down. They always felt like it was walking me through, you know, taking 17 steps. It's kind of funny. If you GPS from, you know, my house in Marietta to Chicago, it'll be 35 steps, but the first 5 of them will be how to get out of my neighborhood. And it's, you know, and then it'll be get on this road and go 600 miles. So it seemed like there would be a lot of time, a lot of ink spent explaining something that is really a fairly simple concept and then rushing through the actual part that's difficult. It'd be very frustrating. I did want to make sure that didn't happen here. So I agree with you. I think I say dense. I confuse that with I'm only going to tell you once. If you didn't get it, go back and read it. You already paid for that page.
I like that. That's right. That's right. That's right. You know, Mike, when you talked about the GPS, whenever I map something out of my house, it always tells me that I have to make a U-turn. I don't. There's this cutaway at the end of my, but it'll say turn right, go up, turn left, make a U-turn. No, just go out, turn left. I'm on my way. And for your analogy there are books like that they tell you things you really don't need, and when they do tell you, it's not always right. But yours is that was a good question, Andy, good comment. This I was kind of hard on you to make sure that it was quality. I think I was, and this is. I'll tell you what it did for me, not that I ever thought about being a landlord, but any thought that I might have had, I said, no, ain't going to happen.
Being a mediator did that to me. I would have thought about maybe doing it one day. And I'm at a point in my life where I never, you know, have learned to never say never. But and I still think, though, the only person for whom I'll ever probably be a landlord is myself in a business context. But, You know, and then even having said that, though, I still entertain the notion from time to time of buying a building that's bigger than I need and subleasing some of the space in it to somebody else. That's a discussion for different discussion for a different time. But the point is, never say never. But you're right. Yeah. I've talked to a lot of people that have had experience with, you know, this evictions, especially because all it takes is one problem tenant. It's a financial nightmare.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully this will help soften the blow.
And let's put this out there for people to consider, that if they're considering becoming a landlord, buying property, all those things you listed, take a look, see at this to see what might happen if and when it goes sour on them. This is according to Georgia evictions, which obviously means that it may be different in Alabama, Pennsylvania, whatever.
Right. Not maybe, almost certainly is.
Okay. Are you aware of what the differences would be? How applicable might this be elsewhere?
On a general level, maybe. You know, because there are some practical considerations in there that I think can probably help no matter where you are. I guess my carrier would probably prefer I let everybody know that I'm only licensed to practice in Georgia, so I can't give advice on any other state. Having said that, and I don't have any experience doing evictions in any other state, only in Georgia. Having said that, you know, there's some, for example, there's one tip that I give in the book that I don't think you'll find anywhere else, which is, again, not to get too technical, but magistrate court is not a court of record. So anything that you introduce as an exhibit in that court, the judge will typically look at it and at the end of the trial will hand it back to you. Doesn't go make it into the file. Well, when the case is appealed, theoretically, the magistrate court record is transferred up to whatever the appellate court is going to be. And if the judge has handed you back your exhibits, they're not in the record. They're not being transferred to the new court. Doesn't mean you can't get them in again. You can, you should, you will. But imagine you have taken copies of documents you know you're going to need. For example, your lease. You know, the written lease that governs your relationship with this tenant that you're about to throw out of the property is always going to be relevant in your case. Well, what if you stapled a copy of that to your complaint that was filed, you know, in the court's record when you first filed your case? Nobody ever thinks of that. I've never seen it done, or I've very rarely seen it done. I've done it myself. You know, that's a kind of a tip that you would find in the book that I think could be applicable everywhere. Now, I don't know, but I would think that, you know, in pretty much every other jurisdiction, it would be allowable and acceptable to do something like that.
One of the thoughts that I'm having is we know that we have people listen live or download the shows across the nation, literally, and there may be another attorney who's listening to this and could be in touch with you. Buy a copy, see how it's done, and create a book for his state or something like that. In fact, I'm thinking right now, having been at my hometown last week, what attorneys do I remember from my hometown to say, hey, have I got an idea and a deal for you?
Well, and the other thing, you know, you're asking about the target market, and I think I've talked a lot about non-lawyers. There's a lot, and I'm going to let out a dirty little secret. None of my learned brethren want me to say this, but there is a lot that we lawyers don't know. There, I said it. And, you know, we tend to, even if we have general practices, and my practice is fairly general, I do a lot of things other than dispossessory things, but no matter how general we are, there's always stuff we don't know and stuff we don't do.
Sure.
And a lot of lawyers don't play around with the dispossessory process at all. They can actually learn from something like this. And, you know, if for no other reason to know that they don't want to do those.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There are lawyers out there that are going to find that this is not worth their time. They can refer out also. Some of my best referral partners over the years have been other attorneys specifically that don't do what I do. My very best referral partner over 10-plus years that I've been doing this is a guy that I met at the Fulton Landlord Tenant Mediation Project who does nothing but criminal work. And he and I have traded work for years.
Wow.
I send all my criminal stuff to him, and he sends most of his domestic stuff to me. I've educated him a little bit on the ones I don't want. But, you know, you have to do that too.
Well, let's give you a chance. You said this isn't all of what you do. Talk to us about your practice. What do you do? What does the firm specialize in?
I do a lot of different things. There are four of us. And we don't really specialize in anything. I used to tell people what we didn't do just because that was more economical, but that's not a good way to market. I will say, though, we don't do much criminal work at all. We do all civil work and all transactional work. The civil side, we do a lot of divorce work and post-divorce cases and domestic relations matters, family law. I don't like calling it family law because it sounds kind of hypocritical, but we do all of that sort of thing, and I do a lot of that sort of stuff. We also handle pretty much any kind of small business litigation that you could ask for. We do a lot of we do some employment litigation. We do some collection work, some garden variety, what I call garden variety, just good old-fashioned, we don't agree on something, mm-hmm. you know. Joint ventures that have blown up, partnerships that haven't worked out, guys that wouldn't pay. We represented, at least until, about 4 years ago when it all hit the fan in the real estate market, we represented a lot of builders. That's not to say that we specialized in mm-hmm. representing builders, mm-hmm. but we did have a lot of them. And builders are interesting. They have a lot of different issues. First of all, they're usually really good at building and really bad at business. A lot of them would learn, sometimes the hard way, often the hard way, but they would learn to rely on us mm-hmm. to help them set up. We would set up LLCs and corporations and that sort of thing for them, and then we would help them figure out how not to actually keep their books. CPAs mm-hmm. and bookkeepers mm-hmm. are good at that, but we would help them with that sort of thing. Negotiating contracts and writing contracts, and because you'd be amazed at how many millions of dollars will change hands on a handshake if you'll let them.
Wow.
So it's really a very broad ranging practice. I've had a lot of experience doing a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. I'm very fortunate to have had that in my career. I think a lot of lawyers my age have not and will not ever have that experience.
So. Well, you came at this, you said earlier that you taught or do teach economics mm-hmm. at a
college. I haven't done it in a while, but I have.
Was that your background before you went into law?
Sort of. I went to the University of Alabama, and while I was a senior there, I got engaged to a junior. So rather than go work for a living and start paying my loans, I decided to stay and get a master's degree. I got my master's degree in economics. And while I was there, I taught the freshman class there.
Okay.
To pay the bills.
Well, what I like about that is the image that you know law, but you also have a really good sense of business or the structure behind it. And that's got to be beneficial for anybody who turns to you for help.
I think so. I mean, I'm not sure how well an economist understands business. All the finance people listening right now are saying, oh, he doesn't know anything about business. He knows about economics.
Okay.
And there's some truth to that, honestly. But economics to me is a mindset. It's a way of thinking. First of all, I personally think we should be teaching it in the third grade. Basic concepts of supply and demand and price and quantity and how those interplay is something that an 8-year-old can grasp mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. should grasp. And if they had grasped it, and if everybody had that understanding, I think we'd be in a very different place as a country right now. But I digress. I just think that the mindset of always sort of implicitly doing cost-benefit analysis in any mm-hmm. action, whenever you're, no matter what you're doing, is a good way of thinking about, just about anything. And it helps to explain a lot of human behavior, frankly, mm-hmm. When you realize there's no such thing as an irrational choice. You just need to understand what the options they think they have are. Mm-hmm. It looks irrational to you because you value things differently.
That's true.
But once you figure out what's valuable, that's a good way to settle cases. It's a good way to figure out what judges are looking for, mm-hmm. et cetera.
So, Mike, how do you get this book out to the marketplace? Is this available off your website? Do you have a tour? Are you doing signings? Do you stand out on the street corner and shout at cars going by? I mean, how do you get it in people's hands?
Do you think that would work?
You never know. I mean, I guess it's what you value, right?
Absolutely. The book itself is, first and foremost in my mind, is a marketing tool. It is not the end. It is a means to an end. The end is growing my practice and being recognized out there for being good at something. Not that I will, not that I don't want to sell the book. I do want to sell the book, but that's not really. So anyway, I'm not. It's a long-winded and kind of convoluted answer to your question. I do have a website, GeorgiaEvictionBook.com.
Yeah.
The payment page isn't up yet because, like I said, I literally got it today, and I didn't want anybody trying to buy the book before I could ship it to them. But I'll get that up very soon. And I expect the main, you know, because I looked at distribution channels, Amazon and, you know, those sorts of things, and I came to the conclusion that if anybody's going to find this book, it's going to be because of my effort.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's the case, then what am I paying Amazon for? So I don't intend to use any of the big boys to actually host this thing or stock it. I am printing them on demand, at least for now. It would be fantastic if I get up to, you know, where I need 10,000 copies a month. Well, I'll explore another solution at that point. Mm-hmm. But I don't anticipate that being a problem anytime soon. So the main way to market it is going to be what the same way I've been marketing myself for about 2 years now, which is word of mouth, referrals. You know, I am exploring and learning how to use social media to do some of that. SEO is obviously a big thing on the internet, you know,
sure.
So that hopefully the GeorgiaEvictionBook.com will be a landing page for anybody looking for help with the dispossessory process. There is some information there already, some forms and stuff out of the book that I made available.
And as he said, it's GeorgiaEvictionBook.com.
Yep.
And you now have two more people that can market it for him, doesn't he, Andy?
That's right.
He does. Well, you know, it's an interesting concept. I mean, something you said that really, you know, takes note is that this book is designed to grow your practice.
Right.
And I think that's a fundamental decision.
Absolutely.
For an author to decide, you know, am I trying to make money off the book or am I trying to grow my business from the book? I mean, with that in mind, do you see this as a one-off, or do you think perhaps maybe there's going to be a series of books based around some of your expertise?
You know, my wife asked me the same thing. And
wives do that.
I
know
it. And my first reaction was, let's slow down. The first one's not in print yet. let's get the first one done, and let me take a breath for a minute before I figure that out. And the short answer to that, I guess, has to be, I don't know. I don't know whether this is going to be a one-off or whether there's going to be another one down the road in some other subject area. I guess it will depend on how well this one grows the practice and whether I want to branch out into another area. There are a couple other areas that I'm kind of good at, but I don't know if there's a market. That's the other thing you have to test, whether there's a real market for that. For example, I'm reasonably good at divorce cases, domestic law. That's a much bigger and more convoluted and complicated topic than the dispossessory process. Dispossessory is, frankly, fairly straightforward. There are very good books out there on, you know, that will help with divorce cases, and I don't know what the market looks like. This was written because there's a market for it. I don't think anybody else has done anything like this. At least I couldn't find anything if they had. So I don't think I could say the same about divorce work. So that obviously would play into it. And then, you know, it's just going to kind of depend on how successful this is, how well I'm able to get out the message, how well I'm able to actually grow the practice because of the book or because I've written a book or something like that. So,
what I see this being able to do for you is to get you speaking engagements in front of service organizations.
And we got sidetracked a little bit, but that was another thing that Andy asked a minute ago, was are seminars planned or anything like that? Yes, that's something I do want to do. In a couple of different contexts, I mentioned that this all started because I prepared materials for a CLE that wound up not happening. It's kind of funny, in a sort of ironic or coincidental way, that I've been asked to do that very same CLE again. It's going to be in December, and I've been asked to do it in two different places, conveniently in the same week. So I'm going to do one in August, in Augusta, and one in Columbus, and that's going to be the first week of December. If there are lawyers out there listening who are curious about that, you can track me down, and I'll be happy to give you more information about that later. But the other thing I've done is I've spoken with, had a couple of discussions with some realtors that I'm close to. They have investors who have come to them because they buy rental properties. One of them said he has a guy that comes to him every 8 months like clockwork and buys a new rental property, and that's just his plan. He's sort of...
Wow.
Yeah. and he pays cash every time, and he's a fan. A guy like that is paying enough attention. I don't know if he's going to want to represent himself. It sounds like he's probably got the means. He's probably got general counsel already. And yet he might still be interested in looking at this just so he understands the process. So when he gets a bill from his lawyer that has charged him X thousand dollars for handling this matter for him, what has actually gone into that process? You know, I think he's got a right to know that. I think,
and
I'm sure if his lawyer's a good lawyer, and I'm sure he is, then his lawyer's probably happy to explain all of that. But it helps to have that kind of confirmation from a third source.
Sure, it does.
So anyway, that that kind of thing is on the horizon as well. I would love to get to the point where I'm doing a couple of those a month for groups of 15 people. That's kind of a goal right now.
What advice would you give to business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals who are contemplating writing a book?
Well, I would recommend you, timing is everything. I managed to make it work, but if I had it to do over again, I probably would have done it at a time where I was not introducing a brand new baby into the world. My son turns one a week from today, and so this has been written while he's been, you know, with us in mm-hmm. the first year. Most of that work has been done over the last 6 months, and that can make it challenging to find time to actually do it, because it is a very time-intensive process. And it's easy to say, well, you know, a 40-page book, because there's about 40 pages, honestly, of substantive material in the book. You know, how long could it possibly take to write 40 pages? And you're right. I can go back to my office and crank out 40 pages before the sun goes down, no problem. Is it going to be publishable quality? Nope.
No.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
And so to get it to that takes hours upon hours upon hours. I was thinking about that this morning and trying to quantify exactly how much time I've put into this. I would bet it's probably on the order of 5 or 6 hours per page.
That's just an interesting way to look at it. As a yardstick. Yeah, yeah.
And so if I'm going to write a 100-page book, I need to have 600 hours available or figure out how long it's going to take me to put in 600 hours. And if I can put in an hour a day, that means it's going to take me 2 years to write this book.
I like that image. That's a good one. That's a good one. Well, people want to be in contact with you. Excuse me. Maybe ask about your law firm, retain your services, or more about your writing journey. How should they be in touch with you?
There are several ways to get in touch with me. I'm on LinkedIn, linkedin.com/in/MikeDunhamLawyer. It's Dunham. The name of the firm, again, is Gibson Deal, Deal, Fletcher, and Dunham. I think we pop up on Google right away if you look for us. If you look for me, you'll probably find a hockey player out of the University of Maine. But if you scroll down a little bit, you'll find me.
Then you'll find the attorney.
Yeah, Mike Dunham, he was on the Olympic team years ago. And some people actually confused me for him at one point because I was wearing a University of Maine hockey hat because my parents went there. They're alumni of the University of Maine. But
is that right?
It's just a coincidence.
I thought maybe you were holding back on me here.
No, if I could play hockey, I'd... Anyway, GeorgiaEvictionBook.com is, okay. I think I've also got GeorgiaEvictionBook@gmail.com is a way to get a hold of me. You know, there are lots of ways to find me. I'm on Facebook. I have a Facebook page for the book.
Okay.
So
great.
Anyways,
well, I also know that you really promoted your appearance today. I have already begun to receive emails from people who wanted to know more about the show. So I thank
Good.
You for that.
Hey,
I
absolutely.
Appreciate that. Well, the clock is on us. It has a habit of doing that every week. We welcome your comments and suggestions about the content and our guests. If you would like to recommend a guest or be a guest yourself on Right Here, Right Now, let us know. Send us an email, whwnbusinessradiox@gmail.com. Thank you, Andy, for handling the controls.
Always a pleasure.
And thank you to my guest, Mike Dunham. I know I just had you give your information, but one more time, they want to contact you.
The easiest way is through the book site, GeorgiaEvictionBook.com or GeorgiaEvictionBook@gmail.com.
Okay, great.
Thanks again, Tim.
Sure. Well, Right Here, Right Now is brought to you each week by Right Choice Services. And you can learn more about Right Choice Services at rightchoiceservices.com. I hope you'll join us next week and tell your friends about the show. Send them an email. Invite them to listen to the show live or to the downloads. Right Here, Right Now broadcasts live every Tuesday morning at 10 Eastern Time at rightherenow.businessradiox.com. And the MP3 version is available later today. I am Tim Morrison. Join us next time when business leaders, entrepreneurs, and professionals come together to discuss the power of the pen and its impact on their business right here, right now.